Chasing Giants with Don Higgins and Terry Peer. Brought to you by Osseo Camo, nature's most lethal camouflage. Follow along as Don and Terry discuss the techniques, strategies, and dedication needed to harvest one of God's most amazing creations, world-class whitetails.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Chasing Giants podcast with Don Higgins. I'm Terry Peer. We're brought to you by Osseo Gear and a long list of wonderful partners. It is Thanksgiving Day. We're recording on Thanksgiving. Both of us getting ready to go have time with our families. So, but we felt that with travel schedules and what's coming on this weekend, we'd go ahead and record today. We're going to talk about transitioning to the late season. We're going to talk about targeting a specific buck. We got a bunch of good information for all of our listeners, especially those who have not filled a tag. But first, Don, it's Thanksgiving Day. We both have a lot to be thankful for, right?
We absolutely do. And one of the things that we are thankful for is all our listeners and the support that we get. And just wish everyone, I know it's you're going to hear this after Thanksgiving, but we hope you had a great Thanksgiving and appreciate the support. Hope you continue to support us.
You know, I was thinking last night, I didn't sleep well last night. I was got a little anxiety today, to be honest with you, about the King David hunt being released because, you know, you try to be as vulnerable as you can and tell the true story, which I don't think a lot of people in the hunting industry do, but just knowing some of the flack I'm going to catch, you know, just the anxiety of that. But I was thinking last night, you know, between the two of us, what this hunting community has provided is I was thinking between the two of us and all of our businesses, we have almost right around 40 employees. Can you imagine putting that into perspective? And a lot of it's the what this podcast and all of our listeners have done in order for us to grow. And, you know, we're able to provide, you know, salaries and jobs for between the two of us, right around 40 families. And it's kind of scary to think about, honestly, because it's a lot of responsibility, but what a blessing all of this has been with such good people that have rallied around us, supported us, and listened to us every week, even when we get off the rails sometimes.
Yeah, we had a all-day meeting Monday at Real World with all the owners. Terry was there as our business advisor. Other folks, important folks in the business were there as well. And I took a different perspective with that meeting than I typically do. And I had some time leading up to that meeting to sit in a tree and just think about things. And, you know, one of the things that I wanted to do in that meeting is listen to what people were saying, not just hear them talk, but listen closely to every comment that was made by every person. And I'm not going to get into a bunch of details here on this podcast, but as I sit and listen to every person, I realize that every person in that room wants the same thing. And yet we all had somewhat differing opinions on different issues, but we all, our hearts were all in the same place. We all want what is good for that business. And I think you can kind of relate that to our listeners too. And each listener, I think, has a different perspective about deer hunting, you know, based on their personal situation. Not everyone has a property that they own that they can manage. Some people are hunting permission property, some hunting public land, and some do own properties of various sizes, but they all bring something of value to the group. Different perspectives are healthy. If we was all the same, it'd be a pretty boring world. And as I think about our listeners on Thanksgiving, it doesn't really matter if you guys are managing properties like Terry and I do, or you're hunting public land or permission properties. We value each and every one of you, and we're thankful for each and every one of you. So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying thank you for your support.
Yep, absolutely. So if you haven't checked out the Chasing Giants YouTube channel, make sure you go check it out. The King David hunt finally released after a year. We were going to release it earlier this year, but Don, you wanted to release it on Thanksgiving Day today.
That hunt, it's more than a hunt. I was so impressed with the first video version that I seen. I have not seen the final version yet. I'm going to be watching it later today. But the first version.
The first draft, you mean?
Yeah. It was just so good that I'm like, we need to push this one to Thanksgiving, because we've always had a special video release on Thanksgiving Day, or we have for the last several years. And I was like, this needs to be the Thanksgiving video. So I hope you guys all, if you haven't already, I hope you'll watch it with your family and provide some feedback, you know, in the comments section there under the video on YouTube. And believe it or not, we read all those comments. So your feedback's important to us. You know, Terry and I, this is our third episode of Chasing Giants. And I think if you'd go back to the first few episodes and compare them to what we're doing today, I think there's a big difference. You know, I think we've recognized the voice that we had, or we have, and we recognize that people look up to us, and we probably didn't always do that so well. And from here going forward, and we've been trying to do that recently, is we're trying to utilize our platform for more than just deer hunting. And the Chasing Assurance podcast that Terry's doing with his dad is a kind of a reflection of that. And, you know, we just hope that you'll share the podcast with others, because we want to do more than just teach them to be better deer hunters. We want to inspire them to be better people. And at the same time, we want to show our humility that we aren't perfect. We've got our faults as much as anyone does. Again, thank you for your support.
Yep. So, you know, Thanksgiving, it's passed a couple days by the time you're listening to this, but we just hope that you had a wonderful time with your family. I'm going to take a couple weeks break from hunting and go. I have an annual trip that I take with my wife. She lets me run wild all over the Midwest during the rut, and I give her the first couple weeks of December. So I won't be back hunting until a little bit further in the late season. You have a tag still left and your original target buck, so we're going to dive into that a little bit. But I want to save that for the second segment. Let's finish up, since we've been all emotional and yippy-yappy about Thanksgiving and thanks, get our housekeeping things out of the way. The Ship Shawana Show, I talked to Derek. Just people, if you're wanting to come up, get your hotel reservations. There's a few hotels, big hotels in Ship Shawana, but don't wait till the last minute to reserve your room for those 2 or 3 day segment. The Wenzel brothers, Bobby Worthington, Joe Miles, Don, Wes. I mean, the list is a whole lot longer than what it's ever been before, of a lot of just wealth of information. And I really suggest you just make it a weekend event and get there. And not only will there be a lot of businesses there, but the amount of just knowledge from the industry, even from like your buddy, Mr. Mitchell. I mean, not a lot of people have heard him talk before.
Yeah. Mike with Mike's Mighty Micros. Is that, you mean Mike Mitchell or Lee Mitchell?
Lee.
Okay. Well, Mike Mitchell's going to be there as well with Mike's Mighty Micros. Lee Mitchell, one of the best deer hunters that I know. He's shot some giants, including one 200 incher. Does a lot of public land hunting in multiple states. He's not just a local guy, but I know he was just in Kansas. He hunts Iowa. He's from the South, spent a lot of time in Georgia. He hunts Texas every single year. So this guy is a well-rounded deer hunter, just like Joe Miles, very successful. And I think you'll be glad that you attended his seminar if you do.
Yeah. Wes Delks is on the speaking list this year. Brent Henderson is coming, and you'll be able to actually get his books. He'll have a booth there, but Bill speaking. You talk about a great speaker, great storyteller, and great guy. I did talk to him this week. He is recovering from his open heart surgery really well. He's not allowed to climb a tree stand yet, but he'll be looking tip-top shape here in Ship Shawana in February. So with all of that out of the way, let's focus on what we want to really talk about in this episode, is transitioning to late season in our second segment after our spot with Osseo. Hopefully you guys took advantage of this huge Black Friday sale, and we'll be right back.
Osseo gear was forged by apex predators. Our two camo patterns are built from nature's most lethal hunters and designed to vanish anywhere in the whitetail's range. Our raptor pattern draws inspiration from the unique feather patterns of a great horned owl, while our rapix pattern is derived from the patterns of bobcats, coyotes, mountain lions, and wolves. But camo's just the start. Every detail of our gear is engineered for bow hunters. From our patent-pending bow hunter and collar to our premium fabrics that keep you quiet, dry, and dialed in all seasons. Osseo gear is made to last, with our lifetime warranty standing behind every stitch. Visit Osseo Gear and use code CHASINGGIANTS for 15% off your first order. That's ASIOGear.com.
Late season hunting, Don. The rut, you've said multiple times that killing a specific buck in the rut's a lot tougher, but late season's a different story. So for our new listeners, let's go into a little bit right now about what is going on with these deer, their ranges, post-rut as it winds down, and maybe even explain a little bit about what happens when we see that odd situation where a doe comes into heat and we got some chasing going around in late season two. Let's just dive into it all.
Yeah, so by the time this podcast releases on Sunday, we're going to be in the late season. And I don't think I've ever seen a year where that transition from the rut to the late season happened quite like this year. You know, as I look at the forecast today, I see cold temperatures that are going to be about 20 degrees colder than what they have been. So they're going to go from highs in the 50s to highs in the 30s. And there's a period of about 3 or 4 days there next week where the temperature's not getting above freezing. But it's staying in the 30s at best, for as far as the forecast goes out. And typically in early December, in recent years anyway, that's not been the case. There's been some fairly warm weather in early December, but we are literally going right from the rut right into late season hunting. And I've shared this before, but there was a period of about 15 years ago where 5 bucks in a row that I killed, and I was targeting each one of these individual bucks, 5 bucks in a row that I killed were all killed after Christmas. All in the late season. And that's a time when a buck gets on a food source that you can kill him on purpose, because you wait for one of those really bad cold fronts, especially if it comes with some snow, and that buck is going to be on his feet before daylight now, or before dark in the afternoon. Now, it might be only 15 minutes, but that's a buck that may have been nocturnal had the temperatures been warmer. If they were 20 degrees above normal, say, that buck very well may lay in his bed till it's pitch black and then get up and wander to that food source. But when those temperatures get brutally cold and the food sources, quality food sources are limited, he's coming to that food source before dark. I've just seen
him like
many bucks.
He's like me with Little Debbie's. When it gets a little cold that morning, you get into your snack pack a little bit earlier than normal just because you got to get some food in you to warm you up.
Well, I can't relate to that analogy too much since I'm on my diet, but... I'd say that's a pretty good analogy. So it's just a perfect opportunity. And, you know, Terry, you mentioned my original target buck, Turning Point. And he will sometimes show up on my farm in those late season brutal conditions. To be honest, I haven't decided if I'm going to shoot him or not now. I guess I probably will if I get a good opportunity, but I'm not going to put a whole lot of effort into it. And the reason for it is I need a target buck for next year. He's made it this far. He may be next year's target buck. You know, I do hope to get some video footage. So I am going to be hunting. I've got a couple bucks on my farm that I've not got good video footage of yet for telling the story years from now if they happen to survive. Some good young bucks that looks like they've got some potential. But, you know, by the time this podcast releases, most of the Midwest is going to be in late season conditions. I know Northern Illinois is supposed to get between 12 and 16 inches of snow. So by the time you guys are listening to this, you may have a foot of snow on the ground. And those deer are going to be all over the food sources. And if you've got a buck that's still alive, he's going to be on them.
Yep. Well, let's walk through the bucks that have been shot on your property this year and how that affects, actually, not just the bucks, but the does also. There's a question, I think, about herd management a little bit later, so we'll save some of this for that. But let's talk a little bit about the number of does harvested and the bucks shot on your place and what needs to happen still through this late season, because you still got, you know, a month and a half to continue to carry out your plan for this special, special property.
Yeah, so last year, as I've mentioned several times, we shot more does than I ever have on this farm. We shot 8 does. It's a small property. Again, there's about 100 acres of deer habitat on this farm. I shot 8 does a year ago, which was significantly more than we've ever shot, along with 4 bucks. And it changed what I seen this past summer, because typically I don't see much out of the bucks in the summer. What I see is does and fawns. They just seem to rule the property. But by shooting all those does, I cut those numbers way back and did not see that last summer. Yeah, I seen some does and fawns, but not to the number that I had in the past. And you know what, right now as we record this, I've got Wes Delks hunting here. It's his fourth day hunting, and he replied or commented yesterday that in all the hunts that he'd been here, so yesterday would have been, he'd had six hunts in morning and afternoon for 3 days, he has only seen three antlerless deer. And so I shot three antlerless deer in back in October, but I started seeing so few that I stopped. I planned to shoot, you know, another eight this year. But when the numbers just dropped off, the sightings dropped off, I backed off and made a decision. And, you know, my son-in-law, Corey, was going to help me. And after he shot his two bucks, he asked me about continuing to hunt and shoot some does. And I'm like, well, I think we need to just hold off for a while and get a better handle on what's here and explain to him, you know, that just ain't, haven't seen the numbers that I would typically see this time of year. This coming cold front is going to really tell the story, because whatever deer are in the neighborhood are going to be on my food sources. I'm going to get a real solid handle. The other thing is, I had a neighbor to the east of me contact me and ask about doe numbers because he wasn't seeing any. And another neighbor a little bit farther east of him was talking to him, and they weren't seeing any. So it sounds like the doe numbers are down in my neighborhood. And guys, you know, the DNR, whatever state you're in, sets the regulations, but it's up to us to, you know, fine tune those. They give us kind of the parameters that we can work within, the season dates and such, the limits of how many we can shoot. But in Illinois, we have no limit on the number of does we can shoot. And we got to take it upon ourselves to take a look at our specific situation, because I'm backing off of the number of does I'm shooting, but there's very well listeners that need to shoot more does. And I can tell you that one thing that I seen this year with the fewer does was more buck activity. I seen more scrapes, more rubs, and I seen more bucks moving in daylight. My cameras just lit up a lot of days. So you can affect the quality of your hunting by how your deer herd is managed. And when you get that buck doe ratio more in line, you're going to see more daylight movement out of your buck.
How far the opposite direction do we got to really watch this? Because, you know, we got people that we know they have to kill deer. My home farm here in Kentucky needs to have, I got a plan in place that people are hunting that to kill does. But what's the repercussions if we go too far the other way, Don? Is it, you know, if we kill too many does, then we don't have the attraction factor of the bucks during the rut?
Yeah, and I think your bucks can start wandering a little farther. Now, they're not going to wander out of their home range, but their home range, unless you own thousands and thousands of acres, most bucks' home range is going to be off of your property to some degree. And if they can't find a doe on your property, guess what? They go wandering looking for them somewhere else. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. Yeah, fewer does makes the bucks more active, but it also encourages them to leave the property. So it's a balancing act. And that's why I quickly backed off. In fact, I wish I wouldn't have shot the three that I shot now. But, you know, we can correct those mistakes by backing off the harvest or increasing the doe harvest, whichever you need. But there's a fine line there where, you know, things are beneficial to you as far as the quality of your hunts, but if you go too far, you know, your bucks could wander off and get shot.
Okay. Let's shift a little bit of topic as it relates to late season right now. And this question is more specific to mature bucks. So not 2 and 3 year olds, not does, but mature bucks over the years. Walk us through what's basically going through that deer physiologically. You know, that deer has probably ran a whole lot. Do they just try to get to where they can survive and rebuild all of that, you know, weight loss that they had and recover? Or are they still kind of feeling froggy if a yearling doe comes into heat, they kick it back in? What's going on in that deer?
Well, I think there's a huge misconception out there that after the rut, the bucks lay up, they consume a lot of feed, they regain lost weight. Folks, I'm telling you, if you take nothing else away from this podcast, take this statement away from it. Bucks do not gain weight after the rut through the winter. I seen it with my captive deer. They're in survival mode now until spring. When spring comes, that's when they start putting the weight back on. And they get run down during the rut. They stay run down all winter. Their metabolism slows down. It's almost like a bear going into hibernation. Their metabolism slows way down. And with the captive deer, I was always giving them deer 365 days a year. I gave them all the food that they wanted. And I didn't have self-feeders where I put 1,000 pounds out there and they get what they want. I fed them every single day. I would take buckets of feed out to the trough, pour it in there, and I would put enough in there that there was just a little bit left the next day. And what I noticed is in the wintertime especially, those deer are consuming right now, a buck will consume about 1/4 what he was consuming back in September. And the thing about it is it would ebb and flow a little bit with the weather. So if we got a cold front, boom, they would consume a lot more feed, but that food was to keep, was not to regain lost body weight. That food was to keep them warm. The digestion process was to keep them warm. They're not putting on weight right now. Whatever they are, they're going to stay there or maybe even lose more weight between now and spring. This is survival mode. Mother Nature knows what she's doing. The metabolism of those deer slows down because the food sources are in shortest supply of any time of the year. She's trying to get them animals to spring, and she does not increase their appetite to do that except during extreme cold conditions when they need it to stay warm.
So talk about a little bit, if the metabolism is slowing down in late season for a mature buck, what's his range doing? Because we've talked about, you know, pre-rut, he makes huge moves back to his summer range. You got homecoming bucks in between does. They come back to possibly their summer range to look for it. Does their range shrink this time of year also?
Typically it does, and it's centered around food, quality food source and cover. If you've got both in close proximity, that's what we try to do with every consulting property that we look at. We want the best bedding cover in the whole neighborhood, and we want the best food sources in close proximity to that bedding cover. And if you do that and you, the human intrusion is minimal, you can get that buck to stay right there on your property in that secure bedding area and hitting those prime food sources. And he may do most of it at night. That's fine. He may, his metabolism is slowed down. He may not consume near as much as we think he should, but it's there. He's always got it in close proximity. And when a deer gets in that position or that situation, he's going to stay close. He's not going to be ranging. And the thing of it is, the whole herd is going to be there. The does and fawns are all going to be there around that security and around that quality food. I you know, I kind of caution a lot of landowners or clients that you don't want to really put too much pressure on your property at that time of the year because you don't want to bump those deer. You don't want to, you know, drive them a half a mile off your property where they're back and forth and they're bedding elsewhere and they're coming back at night. I mean, we want to conserve calories because, again, these deer are not going to gain weight this time of the year. They're either going to maintain or they're going to lose weight. That fat that they put on earlier in the fall, and with the bucks, that metabolism slows down at the beginning of the rut. They just stop eating, and not totally, but from what they was doing in September, early October, I mean, it's a fraction by the time the 1st of November rolls around. And then it just continues to decline up to the late season, and then it just kind of, you know, flat lines with some peaks in food consumption with bad weather events.
All right. I find late season and the physiological side of whitetail fascinating, probably more so than any other thing. But to me, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but to me, we have a lot of people that we talk to, whether they're listeners of the podcast or consulting clients, that think they're going to change a mature buck's range or pattern by throwing a new feeder out, a new feed. And I try to squash that. And we have a company that sells those products. And we still don't say that that's the reason. To me, what we're trying to do with habitat improvements, and everybody's got their list and of ideas that they want to do for next year, you might make a buck come to a standing, say, Gen 2 soybean field during really, really cold weather. That's normally not there if it's the only food. But what I'm really trying to do with habitat improvement is those yearling fawns that are with their mother right now, educating them on where the safest and best nutrition is for 5 years from now. And I really think that people don't look at the long game of habitat projects as much as they should when we're talking about late season. It's, to me, it's really about putting a plan in place that appeals, that these buck fawns remember right now, those ones in the field that are reuniting with their mother after they've been pushed off during the rut.
Yeah, that's a great point, Terry, because, you know, I attract more new bucks to my property in the late season than I do during the rut. Then those bucks are coming for the food. There's no doubt about it. They're coming for the food because I've got the best food sources in the whole township. And I've given this a lot of thought because I've got all these cameras on my property, but I've also got a lot of cameras on surrounding properties. I'm talking like for 2 or 3 mile radius in just about every direction from my farm, I've got these cameras. And so I know bucks that never show up at my farm that are still in the neighborhood. And I know bucks on my farm, if they leave, I know the direction they're likely to go because I've got their picture elsewhere. And what's just fascinating to me is these new bucks that show up in the late season are not bucks typically that were within 2 or 3 miles of my farm. These bucks are coming from a lot further than that, because I've never had their picture. And the only explanation that I can come up with is that these bucks were on my farm as button bucks with their mothers, button buck fawns as with their mothers. The next spring, they dispersed. Mother Nature's way of preventing inbreeding, the young males disperse. And they picked up a new home range, who knows, 5, 10 miles away, whatever. Then the late season rolls around some years down the line, and the food sources, wherever that buck has ended up, are not there. And he's hungry. He remembers where he found food as a fawn, and he comes back. That's the only explanation I can come up with. It's either that, or they can smell these food sources for literally miles. It's one of those two. That's the only way they can find them.
Yeah. Just absolutely fascinating. But with this type of cold weather, one more question before we move on. I want to save time. We got some 5 really good questions this week. But tell people what a mature buck, or let's just talk the whole herd, not specific new buck or mature buck. What is the herd looking for from a nutrition standpoint? Is just throwing out shell corn or ear corn, you know, what they need to survive? Is it fat, protein, starches, carbs? Kind of walk us through a little bit of that, because there's going to be listeners that by the time they listen to this with 10 inches of snow on the ground, that their clover plots are going to be way, way underneath of everything. So think about it from the listener that's trying to make the decision of his rotation and food nutrition plan for next year with food plot.
Well, diversity is key. I mean, just look at our own diets. We don't eat just carbs or just protein or just fat. It's a mixture of both. And when we get low on anything, our body craves it. And it's the same way with these deer. So when it gets cold out, what I've seen is a deer wants a food source that's high in fat. I know there's a thought out there that they like carbohydrates when it gets cold. And I suppose they do to some degree. But, you know, corn is higher in carbs than soybeans are. But soybeans are typically higher in fat, and they go after those. So in the colder weather, I'm telling you, soybeans beats corn hands down every time. Now, I want both. I want to give them both. And on my corn, I want them to have the high oil NutriCrave corn, because it just, here's where NutriCrave really shines. And I think that this is where the serious land manager needs to really perk up and listen here. Let's say that a deer comes out and he eats a 1/2 pound of shelled corn from whatever plot. If that corn is NutriCrave versus ag corn, he's getting more than double the calories. That's going to help him not only stay warm, but get through the winter. So we can't really control the volume of food that a deer is going to eat. He's going to eat what he wants to eat, but we can control the quality of that food. And if we can,
well, you already mentioned that their metabolism slows down. They're only going to consume so much. So when we can double the calories in the volume, that's a big deal.
Absolutely. And that's why diversity and the quality of your soil, you know, a a nutrient-rich soil is going to produce nutrient-rich plants, and those plants are going to produce nutrient-rich food for the deer, whether it be grain or greens. And it's just a cycle that starts with the soil, goes to the plant, then to the animal. And we have a huge control as land managers on that cycle. And it starts with our soil. You know, I think I've got the best crop of soybeans that I've ever had on my farm. I mean, those things were like shoulder high on me. And the grain is not as big because we missed some rains late in the year. There is grain in all those pods, but the grain is not quite as big because of the lack of rain. But the plants themselves are absolutely giant. I think it's due to the soil amendments that I've been doing in recent years. I've used the biochar, I've used the humic, and you know, I'm using various fertilizers. I'm using cover crops. You know, I've talked about the hairy.
You're spraying
veggies.
Mike's Mighty Micros on it when you spray your herbicide. Mike's
Mighty Micros on it. It's just been a continual process of me trying to provide the most nutrient dense food sources that I can, because when that deer comes out in the late season, he may only consume a half a pound or a quarter pound of total food for that day. I want to make sure that it's the most nutrient rich quarter pound or half a pound of food possible.
Sure. Absolutely. All right. Well, if you got further questions, make sure you submit them at chasinggiants.com, and we can dive into it over the next couple of weeks of late season discussion. I just find it fascinating how these animals survive. You got to realize they have ran multiple marathons related to a human. They've ran multiple marathons over the last month, and they're able to live out in these brutal conditions of wind and cold and survive and adapt to whatever habitat they're in. They are such tough animals. It's crazy. Let's pick up our Higgins Hot Seat segment sponsored by 360 Blinds. And my question to you, Don, is take about 3, 4, 5 minutes and talk about the most brutal hunting conditions, cold wind wise, you've had late season. A story that you can comes to mind about hunting in the late season, one of the most, you know, a brutal experience that's come to mind about you having to layer up with your little house on the prairie long underwear.
Well, I can think of a couple of really good stories. One of them goes back a long time. It was probably the late 1980s. And we got just an absolute blizzard, you know, where everything is shut. All the businesses are shut down. Roads are hardly open. And I was just a young guy, not much money. I didn't even have a truck. I had a car, and had a 84 Pontiac Grand Prix. And I took that car, you know, I had my hunting gear in the trunk and such. And I actually drove out of town. There was a really thick old growed up pasture, not too far outside of town, that had a lot of honeysuckle in it. And that honeysuckle would not bush honeysuckle, but vining honeysuckle that would stay green in the winter. And a lot of the smaller trees and saplings and bushes and such had that honeysuckle just vined up all over, just a super, super thick thicket. And the weather was so brutal that I thought the deer are going to be piled into that thicket. They just got to be. And so one afternoon I drove out there, and the roads were closed, believe it or not, but I busted through them in that old Pontiac. And when I got to my hunting spot, there was no way. The ditches were drifted full of snow. There was no way for me to pull my car over and park at the side of the road. So being a crazy kid, I just parked in the middle of the road. I just left my car in the middle of the road, and I got out and got my bow. I went hunting. And I wasn't even sure that I was going to be able to get home when I got out. And, you know, I'm probably 3-4 miles from town. So I wasn't sure if I was walking home or sleeping in my car or what, but I was just crazy about deer. So I'm going hunting. So my thought was, and I mean, it was still snowing at the time, and the wind was blowing, you know, 30, 40 miles an hour, and you couldn't see hardly the length of the car in front of you. So my plan was, I put on this white suit, real cheap white, like hazmat suit. And so I'd blend in with the snow, and I had a white stocking cap with a white face mask. And my idea was I was going to slip around through that thicket, and I was going to see if I could find deer tracks. And I'd know they'd be fresh because how fast the snow was coming down and blowing. And if I found some deer tracks, I was going to follow them with that abominable snowman suit, and I was going to try to shoot them on the ground. Well, I got into that thicket, and for probably about 45 minutes, I'm slipping around, and I'm seeing deer tracks, and I'm actually seeing deer, but these deer are not leaving that thicket. And they're just kind of, you know, running around me and just avoiding me. And the wind's swirling, and I'm not paying attention to the scent, and they're smelling me, and they're just going everywhere. And obviously, I didn't get a shot, but the thing that happened was I recognized that every deer in the area was in that thicket. And I came back a couple days later after the snow, after the storm had passed and the roads got cleared. I came back a couple days later, midday, and I had a stand in that thicket. And my plan was I was going to climb up in that stand with rattling antlers. And hopefully with all those deer in there, I could rattle one in. Well, I got to my stand, and back in those days, I didn't own property at that time. I was hunting permission properties, and I would always take out my bottom four steps, use screw-in steps, and I always take out my bottom four so nobody could climb into my stands. And so I get in there to hunt, and I've got my rattling antlers, and I get to my tree, and I realize, crap, I ain't got my screw-in steps. So I thought, well, this is probably not going to work anyway. I'll just sit here on the ground. I found a place in some thicker brush, and I'll just try to rattle from the ground and see what happens. And I rattled in and missed two different good bucks. I'm good at that time, you know. There was an 8-pointer that was probably in the 130s, and then there was a 10-pointer that was probably about 150. And I rattled both them bucks in and missed shots at both of them because of the thick brush. And right beside me is the tree that's got my stand in it. If I'd have remembered my screw-in steps, I'd have had good, clean shots to those bucks, and I didn't. That going out there and the conditions being so bad that I had to park my car in the middle of the road and just leave it and hope nobody come along, that's a hunt that I'll probably never forget.
I can just envision, what is it, the big marshmallow man, you know?
Yeah, Michelin man.
walking through a thicket trying to stalk a deer. So if we only had a YouTube video of that these days, maybe we should reenact it if you guys get about 12, 15 inches of snow. What do you think?
Well, we're not going to reenact it on my property because I don't want to run the deer off, but if we could find a thicket somewhere.
All right, we'll be right back after a break from Midwest Land Group with our listener-submitted questions this week.
Does your real estate agent know the difference between a rub and a scrape? Or did they ask how many deer you caught this year? At Midwest Land Group, our agents evaluate the land the way serious hunters do, because it's exactly who we are. From surveys, soil types, floodplains, and easements, to timber quality, tree stands, access, and food plots. Whether you're interested in buying or selling, work with an agent who speaks your language. Visit MidwestLandGroup.com to connect with one today. Midwest Land Group. Buyers, sellers, land. Connected.
All right, our first question comes from Brian Byers from Mount Zion, Illinois. He says, thank you, Don and Terry, for both an entertaining and educational podcast. Don, in the past, you have shared many techniques for chasing mature whitetails based on science. For the future, can you list a couple of topics that aren't fully understood yet that you think could use some more scientific research put into them to understand better why mature bucks do what they do? Thank you guys for a great podcast. Well, you know, the thing that I am still struggling with is the home range and movement patterns of bucks. And I think the reason that it's so difficult to really grasp is because these bucks are individual. And what one buck does, another buck's going to do something totally different. And we're trying to put all these bucks in the same category where he's a 5-year-old, so he's going to do this, or he's a 3-year-old, so he's going to do that. And I don't think that we give them enough credit for being individuals. And if you put it, use a human analogy. So, you know, I've got a pattern in my life where every winter I travel all over the country on consulting visits, and you don't know where I might show up. In October and November, I'm typically close to home and don't range very far. Other people have totally different patterns. Other deer hunters, when October, November rolls around, they hit the road. They don't live in a state where there's big deer, so they hit the road, and they're hunting Ohio and Iowa and Kansas, and their pattern is totally different than mine. Well, I think with mature bucks, it's the same thing. They're basically doing the same thing, but they do it differently. You know, some of them have small home ranges. Some of them have huge home ranges. I think one of the reasons that the turning point buck has been so difficult to get a shot at this year is because his range is huge. And the small portion of his range where I'm allowed to hunt, he's just not there much. Now, I have picked up some information on that deer through both trail cameras and observations that I think that next year I will get that deer killed. And maybe this year yet. I don't know. It probably depends on the weather as much as anything. If he gets driven to my property and starts hitting the food sources, there's a good chance I could kill him this year. But I think my best chance is next year based on what I've learned. So I think if we could learn more about how individual bucks are and not try to pigeonhole them into smaller categories based on their age or the region they live in or whatever, I'd find that very interesting. And I always wish that, you know, I had a buck in my neighborhood that had a radio collar on him that I could, you know, have access to, not to kill him, just to see what he does. You know, like one thought that comes to mind, we just had our firearm season last weekend, is how do these bucks avoid such intense hunting pressure? You know, you got guys out there driving every little patch of cover and chasing these bucks, and they've got weapons. You know, today they're easily shooting over 100 yards with the rifles that are legal today in states like Illinois. Where do these bucks go to survive? And because they do, you know, every year, yeah, some of them get killed, but every year some of them survive. I just would find it just fascinating to know where these bucks go. And the other thing is, how tight do they hold? I'm convinced that a mature buck holds as tight as a rabbit when he's got danger nearby. So you walk through the woods or the thicket and whatever, I think there's a lot of mature bucks, they don't get up and run, because when they do, they get killed and then they don't live to maturity. I think a lot of them just put their chin to the ground and hug the ground as tight as they can in the weeds and the brush and let people walk by. I have no doubt that I've walked within 20 yards of many mature bucks over the years and never knew it.
It's I think that would be fascinating to have a collar, because you look at, you know, your segment of the King David hunt where you explained that buck, you know, going, what, 6-7 miles away crossing an interstate. So the Trump buck that you shot is another perfect example of just how much these bucks can move. So fascinating. Let's go into the next question here.
This one comes from Randall Barr from Bluebell, Pennsylvania. Says, hi, Don. I've heard you say many times that the Illinois DNR and other states do not manage for mature bucks. I understand how you can manage for population, more tags, especially doe tags, and how you can manage for buck to doe ratios, more doe tags. But what recommendations would you have for managing for mature bucks? If one of the answers is limiting crossbow season, what dates would you allow crossbows? Well, Randall, you've opened a can of worms there that I could take in about 10 different directions. But, you know, the main thing with managing for mature bucks is you've got to take the pressure off of the younger bucks. You've got to get more mature or young bucks to survive to maturity. And whether that's through a one buck limit or, you know, limiting the length of the seasons, you got to cut down on the buck harvest that you're currently doing, because the majority of a buck harvest is always going to be younger bucks, and you got to allow more of them to live to older age classes. So there's a lot of things you could do. As far as the crossbows, you know, I'm against crossbows for able-bodied people in archery season. If you want to have a crossbow season, you know, have a late primitive weapon season, I guess, although I'm not sure how primitive they are, where you would include them in with muzzleloaders. So in my home state of Illinois, what I'd like to see is, first of all, I'd like to see crossbows legal for anyone with any kind of, you know, severe physical limitation. I don't want to see them legal for youth. I think a youth needs to almost pay an apprenticeship type, you know, before they take to the woods and are allowed to hunt. I mean, when I grew up, we didn't have crossbows and we had kids hunting, but, you know, they'd go with their dad until they was big enough to pull a bow back. That was, I think 40 pounds was the limit or the minimum draw weight. So we don't have that today. Instead of these kids going along with dad and watching and learning the ropes that way, we're throwing a crossbow in the hands of a 5-year-old. And by the time that kid is 15 years old, he's lost all interest. And I don't think we're doing a good job recruiting based on that, but that's a rabbit hole that I'll stop going any further down. But really, we got to get more of those younger bucks to older age classes, and there's a number of ways to do it. Limiting non-resident hunters in states like Illinois, where there is no limit. Hunting on public land in Illinois today is an absolute joke. And I've got friends that hunt public land here locally that say they're never doing it again. And by the time November rolls around, you know, And there really is no hardly mature bucks on public land in Illinois anymore, as well as the number of deer is way, way, way down on public lands. I've got trail cameras right now on three different public land projects, I guess you'd call them, three different counties. And shoot, I don't know that I've got a buck, maybe 1 3-year-old buck out of all the pictures I've got all since July. Yearlings and 2-year-olds is about it. I've noticed a decrease in my cameras, the quality of the bucks on my cameras on public land. So how are you ever going to go to public land and kill a mature deer if they're not there? And that's going to affect not only that public land, but it's going to affect all the private land close to that public, because the deer aren't, they don't know the line. The deer on the private ground near public, they're going to venture over and get shot as well. So there's a lot of things. I wish I was in charge of this deer herd. For give me 5 years, we'll have the best deer herd on the entire planet. And everybody that hated me at the beginning of that 5 years would probably, well, they wouldn't love me because they wouldn't have enough character to change their mind, at least openly. But I could turn this deer herd into the best on the planet in 5 years, maybe less.
Take it to the bank and do your Trump dance.
There you go. This one comes from Brandon from Alverton, Kentucky. Says, Don and Terry, I'm curious about your input regarding food plots in big timber settings. I've heard for years about making your property different from the neighbors with food cover, etc. Create thick bedding, lots of food, etc. However, after multiple years of being next to a large unmanaged timber sanctuary and surrounding private landowners with large timber, I still seem to struggle. I feel like acorns are always in play as a preferred food source. Even as a bait state, the deer don't come to those bait sites frequently. Minimal doe presence on the plots and bait once the acorns drop. Pressure is low on my property and surrounding it till rifle season. Even though I see large deer on camera every year, they are extremely hard to hunt. My real question is, are big woods guys always at a disadvantage versus ag ground? Should I maybe try switchgrass CRP versus large food plots? Do I need to adjust my strategy and dive more into the sanctuary areas on my farm? Curious on both your thoughts. Thanks. Well, Brandon, I do think that the big woods guys are at a disadvantage to the guys in farm country. I got to give you guys that. If you're hunting big timber, probably not going to be as successful as someone like me that's hunting ag country. That's just the simple truth of the matter. It's a lot easier, for one thing, to get those deer within range in broken up farm country. They're more limited on where they're going to go because they're more limited on the amount of cover. We've got those big open spaces on where a mature buck is very unlikely to be. So, You are correct there. The big timber is a disadvantage, but you've got one huge advantage in your favor, and that's the fact that you own or control a piece of property. And you almost say in your submission that your neighbors are doing nothing. It's big, open, mature timber surrounding you. You got to make yours different. Make your timber different even. So we tell our clients all the time that if you want to kill big deer consistently, you got to hunt them on the properties where they bed. You need to get those deer bedded on your property. Maybe you need to cut every tree on your property almost and create a clear cut, a regrowth of, just thick saplings, briars, weeds, things like that. I guarantee you the deer will be in there bedding. You'll be creating browse for those deer that they can't find in big open timber. And then you combine that with a diversity of food sources, greens and grains. I don't care how much deer like acorns, and I know they love acorns. They're not going to live on just acorns. They want diversity. No different than us going to the buffet. We're not going to just sit there and eat mashed potatoes. We're going to, throw some fried chicken and roast beef and whatever else on the plate as well. Those deer like diversity of food sources. You get them bedded on your property with the best bedding cover that also offers the best browse, and then you throw those diverse food plots right there at the edge, and you're going to have success.
Okay. And get the next one up on the screen for you.
This one comes from Anonymous from Pennsylvania. It says, Hi, Don and Terry. I've been planting NutriCrave corn for the last 4 or 5 years and have been a big advocate as to how deer and other wildlife, including crows, prefer it over the ag corn I used to plant. The ag corn would last until turkey season. I'm lucky if the NutriCrave corn lasts until muzzleloading season in early January. I'd been telling a local cattle farmer about it, and he was intrigued by the high oil, high energy content. He asked his seed supplier about high oil content corn in general, and they told him it's true, the oil content is higher, but you better not be feeding it to your livestock as they can't digest the high oil content. It was developed for the ethanol industry, not as a feed product. I did an internet search, and based on that, it said high starch, not high oil corn, was developed for ethanol production, and the high oil is great for feed as long as the overall diet is not higher than 6 or 7% fat. Given your knowledge of both the corn and the cattle industry, can you clarify if NutriCrave corn is good for cattle feed? Also, another farmer asked me what the yield is of NutriCrave corn versus standard ag corn. I know you originally said you expected it to be lower, but what results are you seeing now? Well, a lot to dig into there. So let's start with the fat content for a feed ration, which he says 6 or 7% is maximum. You know, when I had the captive deer, and I'm going back at least 10 years here when I tell this story. So at the time, it was recommended that your fat level in your deer feed would be about 5%. And so we was shooting, basically in the wintertime, we would want our feed to be 16% protein and 5% fat throughout the year. Then during the antler growing cycle, when the fawns were nursing, we would bump that protein level up to about 18%, but the fat level remained at 5%. Well, some guys were bumping that fat level up, you know, to 7-8%. And I had a captive deer breeder tell me that, and he had some giant deer, that his fat level was up closer to 15%. Well, I was a little bit skeptical, but he had such big bucks that I decided I was going to mess with my feed ration. So I bumped the fat level up, and the highest fat level I ever fed my deer was 11%. So I would send in samples of feed from time to time as I changed my feed ration to get it analyzed, and I'd learn the nutrient content. And for a period of time, and actually at the end of my captive deer experience, the last 2 or 3 years, I was feeding fat levels 10% and above. I wanted to be above 10%. And the deer were doing excellent. You know, I had the biggest, healthiest deer that I'd ever had with those high fat levels. I think the idea that you can't feed more than 6 to 7% fat is just totally false based on my experience. With cattle, you know, a year ago, I fattened out a group of cattle using NutriCrave corn in the ration. It wasn't just NutriCrave corn, but, you know, NutriCrave corn and some other supplements to get the micronutrients and things in line. But those cattle did fantastic. And I remember the slaughterhouse saying that those were some of the fattest cattle they'd ever seen. Whether that's good or bad, I'll leave it to everyone's opinion. But, you know, the fat is the marbling in the meat that makes the meat tender, makes it juicy, makes it flavorful. So some fat in your beef is definitely desirable. With the deer, the NutriCrave corn, I think your guy is off base a little bit. Maybe because he wants to sell you different corn. I don't know, you know, what his reasoning may be, but I'm telling you, NutriCrave corn is a fantastic feed. You ask about the yield. Typically, there is some yield drag, but I can't say how much because it varies by soil. You know, you ask a corn farmer, and he's going to tell you that, you know, he's not planting one variety of corn across multiple fields. They've got these today's hybrids dialed in so much that they know which varieties are going to do best on which soil types. In fact, they've even got planters today where they can have multiple varieties of corn in that planter, and using soil maps and GPS of where that tractor's at, that planter will switch from one variety of corn to another variety of corn automatically as it drives from one soil type to the next soil type. That's a long way of saying the NutriCrave corn yield and the yield drag is going to vary based on the soil type it's grown in and the region it's grown in even. But saying that, I know of two instances, one in Illinois, one in Iowa. Both growers of NutriCrave corn were ag farmers. I mean, they grow hundreds or thousands of acres of corn every year. They know what they're doing. And both guys got yields over 300 bushels an acre with NutriCrave. I think really the only way to know how it's going to perform on a certain soil, certain region, is to plant it. I mean, you may get a yield drag that's who knows, 25%. But you may get a corn that hangs right with the best hybrids for that area and that soil. There's just no way for me to say. All I can do is relate to the experiences that I know of and share those with you. But do not be afraid to feed high oil NutriCrave corn to livestock. We got a lot of guys growing it right now just to feed their livestock.
Well, the farmers that have adopted using NutriCrave, the philosophy there is they're mixing a feed ration. So if you have a dairy farm, chicken farm, whatever, you're mixing a feed ration with corn, some type of filler, whether it's ground hay or whatever, with different things. Dairy farms use molasses. They use soybean meal to get the complete nutrition content where it's at. Where people are using the NutriCrave is the corn is, if they can get that much more nutrients out of the corn itself, it minimizes the protein input cost from the soybean side, which is more expensive. So then their feed ration goes way down. So the farmers that are adopting this in the livestock industry are basically not saying we're only feeding corn. They're adjusting the input cost of the other things they need for their ration because the corn has such better nutrients in it that it helps get the numbers where they need to go without the high cost of other inputs.
Yeah, to dig in that just a little bit deeper, every livestock species, whether it be poultry or hogs or cattle or whatever, their protein requirement is going to be higher than what the corn has. Typical ag corn is going to have a protein level somewhere around 7, 7.5, maybe 8%. 8% would be the very best. It's typically more like 7 to 7.5% protein. The feed rations that are needed for this livestock is typically in like the 16% level. So they've got to add something to their corn to bump up that protein level. You know, with the NutriCrave, your protein level is going to be like 10, 11, even 12% protein. You're still shy of that 16, but you don't have to put as much soybean meal or alfalfa meal or whatever it is that you're using as a protein source. You don't have to put near as much of that in. And that's the most expensive ingredient in your feed ration is your protein source. So you don't have to use near as much of that to bump your level up to get to your 16% target.
Yep. All right. Well, we're running a little bit over this week. We'll save question five for next week's show. When we come back, I will be on a remote location. Can't wait to let Don see where I'm going to be. It's his favorite place on earth. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, thank you for all the support. Make sure you check out Just Release Session 2. It looks like it's going to go to Session 4. There's been, on the Chasing Assurance podcast, there's been so many people ask clarifying questions of how they've been affected by this this thing of divorce, remarriage, and the questions of salvation that Dad is probably even going to extend this into 4 sessions now. So make sure you're checking that out on all platforms by searching under Chasing Assurance or watching on Wednesday mornings here on our YouTube channel. Make sure you check that out. And then obviously the hunt videos, and we will be back next week for episode 302, diving in further into this late season in December and maybe with a lot of cold weather here.
Yeah, I can't wait to get on the road and catch up on those Chasing Assurance podcasts. I listen to my podcast when I'm driving and just got so much other stuff going on, but I'll be on the road a lot here starting this week with some consulting. So anyway, appreciate everyone tuning in this week. Hope your Thanksgiving was great. Get out there and chase those late season bucks. Appreciate your support. God bless.
Chasing Giants has been brought to you by Osseo Camo. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for another episode of Chasing Giants.
Hey, everybody. I hope you're doing well. Hope you enjoyed your Thanksgiving. What a wonderful time it is to just be with family and friends. And hopefully all you guys are having a successful deer season. I have not punched my tag yet, but there's still plenty of time left here in Kentucky with bow season. But anyway, I kind of want to talk about Thanksgiving tonight. So Thanksgiving was obviously on Thursday. I'm recording this on Friday, Friday morning actually. And for the first time, our family, my wife and I, hosted Thanksgiving this year for our family. And wow, it was a big success, and it's so great to just be able to spend time with family and friends and all of those things. But I got to thinking about Thanksgiving, and you know, every time this time of year rolls around, we're always thinking about what are we most thankful for. And there are a litany of things that we could mention. Number one, of course, being our Lord and Savior. No doubt we are most thankful that we have a Lord and a Savior in which we get to worship and praise, and that we've been saved by, and we're so thankful for Him. We're thankful for our families. We're thankful for our kids. We're thankful for our jobs. We're thankful for just all the blessings that the Lord has just bestowed upon each and every single one of us. But I think there's some things that maybe we ought to be thankful for that maybe we don't always see it as something to be thankful for. And I kind of tell you what I mean. I'm going to tell you a story here this evening. Hopefully I have enough time to get through this. It's kind of long. But so a few years ago, June of 2023, my wife and I, we had two kids at the time. My oldest was 2. And my youngest was just born. I think she was a month old around this time. She was born in May of 2023, so she was a month old. Anyway, I was at work one morning when I got a phone call from my wife that our oldest daughter, who is 2, couldn't walk, couldn't get out of bed. And my wife, being sort of the worrier that she is, called in a panic and a frenzy, which obviously, and didn't really know what was going on. So I left work to go see and found my 2-year-old little girl in bed, crying and screaming in pain that she couldn't walk and that her legs hurt. Mind you, the day before, she was completely fine. And unsure what to do, we called, obviously, the doctor. We were able to get in. We practically had to carry her everywhere. Long story short, we were sent to Children's to see what was going on. Her knees were both extremely swollen. Her left ankle was swollen. And at this point, it had gone to her right wrist as well. We had no idea what it was, no idea what to think, and it was very, very difficult seeing your 2-year-old in that way. It got to the point where it would take her, because this went on for a little while before we could actually get into Children's to be seen, about a week, I guess, and it was taking her about 3 hours or so to get walking in the morning, and at that it was very gingerly. By the time we got into Children's, we were seeing a rheumatologist because the thought was that there may be an autoimmune issue, which was some sort of arthritis, and sure enough, that's what it was. We saw the rheumatologist, was able to see the top doctor at Children's Hospital in Cincinnati. And he had been practicing for 44 years or so at the time. Great, great guy. And with meeting him, he confirmed what our fears were at the time, that she had what was called JIA, which is juvenile idiopathic arthritis. And she still was struggling to walk. We were unsure if it was going to get worse, if it'd get better, or what the cure was. So in meeting with the doctors, they told us that there's a chance that it could get worse, that it could spread to more joints. And one day, eventually, pretty much paralyzed her to where she couldn't move because the arthritis was so bad. We knew that there were kids that had been confined to wheelchairs who had that same disease. And of course, we were just devastated. We didn't know what to think. I mean, we didn't know how to really navigate and maneuver through that. We'd never been through anything like that, especially with your children and that being your oldest. And we had a newborn at home that was just a little over a month old. It was very difficult time in our life. And so anyway, when we were trying to navigate through all of that, to figure out what to do, we just kept praying, Lord, what is this? What are we to do about this? Lord, make it better. Make it go away. We don't want to see our daughter like this, or we don't want it to get to this point. But Lord, your will be done. So that was our prayer. And we'd gone back and forth to Children's for weeks now. I think we were going once every week, once every 2 weeks to get through it, to see if it was getting worse, if it was getting better. It wasn't getting better. It had spread to a couple more joints at that time. And so treatment. Once we got blood work back and was trying to figure out, she did a, I think maybe an MRI, I can't remember. But so once we got to figure out what the treatment plan was, they told us that there's a certain pill that she could take that was basically a type of chemo that would kill the inflammation and allow the inflammation to go away and the joints be better to where she could move better. Well, that didn't really sit well with us because we didn't know. I mean, giving our two-year-old a chemo pill was a type of chemo pill anyway, just didn't seem right. It just didn't sit well with us. And so we went home, and so we'd pray about it and figure out what we needed to do. And my wife was just so earnest in trying to figure out maybe a better way. And not that we didn't trust the doctors, it wasn't anything like that. But I say all that to say this, that the Lord answered our prayer and led us to a place called Covenant Health in Florence, Kentucky. And it's a kind of a holistic approach to medicine. And so we thought, you know, what do we have to lose here? We knew a couple people had been going there that had faced some adversity as well with their own bodies and had come out very well on the other end. And so we just prayed about it and we thought we'd give it a shot. And we did. And long story short, 2.5 years later to this very day, our daughter's arthritis is completely gone. She's completely healed. The team at Children's couldn't believe it. I don't say all that to put any kind of doubt in them. That's not what I mean at all. But the Lord answered our prayers. And basically what I want to say through all of this is this. When all of that was going on, wow, you talk about difficult seeing your child in that situation. But what I've learned 2.5 years later is that the Lord often deals trials to perfect us, to make us stronger in our faith, to strengthen our faith. And it reminds me of what James writes in James chapter 1. Where James says this, chapter 1, starting in verse 2. He says, my brethren, he says, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. And let me tell you something. I've learned more in my life, and the Lord has taught me so much more in those 2.5 years than the other 33 years combined of my life. And I've learned to be thankful for the hardships. I can't tell you how many blessings have come from that, that situation. The relationships that's been built, the testimony for one, the answered prayers, the people that rallied sort of around us, our church, our family, friends, neighbors, I mean, you name it. I remember hearing that our daughter was on a prayer list at a church somewhere in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I was just shocked. I'm like, how in the world? Who's in New Mexico that heard about this? And of course, we heard the story. It was a friend of a friend of a friend, and it just got passed down. There were people in other states that were praying for our daughter. And wow, the power of prayer was just amazing. I mean, we couldn't even believe how the Lord was working. But not just that. We learned so much, you know, we gained so much knowledge in the sort of the health field of how the body works and operates and the diets and all those things and the supplements that she was on. And now that's what we have all three of our kids taking in. And, you know, their health is far better than most people's. And it's just been amazing to see how the Lord has worked through this. But one thing that I have to say that the Lord has done, at least for me, is He's taught me to be patient. He's taught me to trust Him fully, trust Him more. And just the amount of people who carry each other's burdens within the church is just, until you're in a situation like that, it is just so amazing to see. And so basically, I just want to tell you this Thanksgiving, is that while there is so much to be thankful for, our blessings, our family, our friends, our jobs, the church, the Lord, of course, and all that He's done in our lives, the fact that He's saved us from our sins and that He's redeemed us and now He works through us and all those things, don't miss being thankful for the trial also, because it could be that very trial that teaches you the most, that helps you to endure, to persevere, to be patient, to grow in Christ. And let me tell you, that has been the single greatest thing that has happened in our family's life. As weird as that may sound, as crazy as that may sound, because it breaks my heart that my daughter had to go through that. But at the end of the day, the amount of blessing that has come from it far outweighs and has far surpassed any of the bad that was there at the time. And it's awesome. His protection, His provision through all of it. And so I just want to remind you what James says, count it all joy. You could even translate that as just to be thankful. Paul often reminds us, the believers in the churches that he wrote to, be thankful in all things, through everything, give thanks. And then James says, count it all joy when you face various trials because of what the trial is going to do. I want to remind you that of that this Thanksgiving. Probably not something we think about, but be thankful for even the difficulties and the hardships and the trials that the Lord allows us to go through. Would you pray with me? Father, I just thank You so much for all that You do. And Lord, I'm just so grateful for the trials that You bring us through. Lord, it is like refining us through the fire, that we become more and more like You. Lord, the trials can often be very difficult, lingering, a struggle, extremely hard. But Lord, we know that You know exactly what You're doing, that You are sovereign, that You are trustworthy, and Lord, at the end of it all, You're going to be glorified. And Lord, that is most of all what we want. We want You to be glorified through all of it. And so, Father, we just thank You. We thank You for all of our blessings. We thank You for our family, our friends, our neighbors, co-workers, Lord. Of course, the church in which we are a part of. And we're just so thankful that we have like-minded believers that we can carry and share each other's burdens with. Father, I thank you for the difficulties that you brought us through. We thank you for the lessons that it's taught us and that we've learned from them. Lord, we just ask that when the more trials and difficulties come later in the future, Lord, that we would be mindful of what you've brought us through, and that we'd be thankful for what you're doing, and that we'd understand, Lord, that we can be joyful through it, we can be thankful through it, knowing that you're going to work it all out for your good and for your glory. Father, we just love you. We ask that you guide and protect us, lead us, and instruct us, and that everything we say and do would give you honor and glory. For it's in your Son Jesus' name we do pray. Amen.